Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your A to Z form of musical analysis and cultural criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And today, for the first podcast of 2016, we're going to do the last exercise in looking back at 2015. And we're going to talk about the year in jazz. And with us today is Nate Chenin. Hey, Nate.
Happy New Year, Ben.
To you, too. There's a couple of ways to talk about what happened in 2015 in jazz. There's the obvious critic-y way of what were aesthetically great records that there was a consensus around. But then there's what did people actually notice who weren't specifically looking for it?
You mean it's not total overlap?
Yeah, no, it's not total overlap. In fact, fascinatingly, it's not total overlap. But let's start with the great records that we noticed and a lot of our colleagues noticed too. One of them was Rudresh Mahathapa's Bird Calls.
Very, very good record.
This record is, interestingly, a repertory album. It's based on Charlie Parker, but it's like no other Charlie Parker-related record that I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's almost as if the Charlie Parker material functions on a kind of, you know, cellular level, and it's been reconstituted so radically that you only really can see it with special instruments. But, you know, at heart, this is a showcase for really really solid band and an interesting band, one that introduces one new voice in the trumpeter, Adam O'Farrell.
Yeah.
I think he was 20 at the time that he made this record. Mm. It also has a killer rhythm section with Matt Mitchell on piano, Rudy Royston on drums, and Francois Mouton on bass.
Yeah.
And this band is just slashing and brilliant and can get superheated, can get very kind of cool and chill. And Rudresh's alto saxophone, which has always been a really strikingly distinctive sound, he just kind of sluices through everything. And the band, remarkably, is just always right there with him.
I saw this band play this stuff before I heard the record. If somebody were to explain it to you, it sounds a little high-flown, a little tricksy,
mm-hmm.
like, we're going to give you this Charlie Parker stuff, but it's all scrambled. You know, it's totally scrambled.
Yeah.
But the band was incredible.
Yeah.
The band was, it was totally like full-throated, intuitive, interactive. You know, the band was just going for it.
One thing that I found interesting about this album is, you know, we expect this from Rudresh Mahathapa. He's not a brand new guy on the scene. We know that he's capable of really intense and accomplished music. But this album was crowned Album of the Year in the Downbeat Critics Poll. It was tied for first place in the NPR Jazz Critics Poll. You know, there was a real consensus behind this record among critics. And I find that interesting because there's almost a way in which the Charlie Parker repertory angle is like Lucy holding the football, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the quality of the band and, you know, everything you just said, like, we heard it, we recognized it, we knew that this was, you know, something really special and important.
So from that record by Rudresh Mahathapa, the alto saxophonist, the record is called Bird Calls. Let's hear On the DL, which is an interpolation of Donna Lee. Okay, Nate, let's talk about what was visible. What did the people actually see if they weren't paying attention to jazz per se?
Well, there were a few people who had a big year coming out of the jazz world and into the sort of broader sunlight. One of those is someone that I wrote about a little bit, and he was just the subject of a 60 Minutes profile. He's 12 now. His name is Joey Alexander. He's quite a good pianist and, you know, a phenomenon, somebody that people are really interested in, and people that I dare say don't own a jazz record may not even care to own a jazz record. But, you know, the story of this young prodigy from Indonesia who has now sort of made his way into the upper echelons of jazz culture in New York, it just struck a chord with people.
Now, it's exceedingly rare that a jazz musician will have a whole segment devoted to him on 60 Minutes. For those who didn't see it, what was the angle other than here's a very
look at
smart,
this kid.
Young,
look at this amazing kid.
Man.
That was it. You know, it was just like, check this out. I think Anderson Cooper said something in his first line or something was, we've never seen a talent like Joey Alexander. You know, it was just
that right?
Or something like that.
Was the jazz a side issue? In other words, could they have done the same segment about him if he were a painter or a filmmaker or a clothing designer or whatever?
I got the sense in the 60 Minutes piece that the jazz was an inconvenient problem to be solved.
You mean, how do we make this fact connect with the larger audience?
Right. Like, how do we let you know that this is difficult? That what he's doing
right.
is, you know, so the questions were along the lines of, well, are you just making it all up as you go along? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, poor Joey is 12 and English is his second language. And, you know, I think Anderson Cooper at one point said, like, well, what is swing? Which is a difficult question for people who've
been, for a grown-up.
Yeah.
Yes.
For people who've been swinging, you know, their whole lives.
Yeah.
So he's just been thrust into a position of, you know, like unbelievable media attention and acclaim. And, you know, one interesting thing about his story to me, as someone who has written about him and met him, he is at once embraced and kind of held at arm's length by the jazz world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there is skepticism and, you know, a kind of grudging admiration in a lot of circles. And at the same time, he's, you know, being championed by Jazz at Lincoln Center. He has quite a few really influential supporters from this world. So it's going to be really interesting, I think, to kind of trace where this story goes. You know, what is the Joey Alexander career going to look like when he's 24?
Well, let's talk about one other person who was talked about a lot in not necessarily jazz circles, and that is Kamasi Washington. If you read, general readership music journalism,
mm-hmm.
if you read Pitchfork,
right.
you've come across something about Kamasi Washington.
He had the consensus jazz album of the year among people outside the jazz community.
And why do you think that was?
Well, this is an album that just had so much life. I mean, it's a powerful statement. You know, you put it at the top of your best albums list.
I did.
I feel like maybe I should be asking you, so I will.
Hmm.
Why do you think this album spoke so clearly and so loudly?
I'll say this. I saw the band a year and something before the record came out, and I thought, unless I'm completely fooling myself, this band is really great. I feel like I would do anything to see this again. I saw it again a year later, and I thought, yep, I believe I was right the first time. And then here comes the record. And the record is, you know, sort of titanic. What I saw in those club dates was seriously loose and fluid, going for it, kind of wildness, different from what you heard on the record.
Mm-hmm.
I was so pleased that they could organize it into some other shape than just what they throw together every Monday and Wednesday night at these clubs in LA,
right.
that I thought, well, this is this kind of thing doesn't happen very often. The majorness of the statement, three albums, all these incredibly long songs, the choir, the orchestra, What I'm trying to say is that I was influenced by having seen the group live.
Yeah.
There has been a backlash against Kamasi Washington.
Oh, boy, yes.
Predictably from the East Coast,
mm-hmm.
I would say. A little bit of Emperor Has No Clothes. Also a little bit of, yeah, we've heard this kind of music before. There's
right.
nothing really new going on here.
And there is a generational split. I found that, you know, if you are a jazz critic, let's say over the age of 50, first of all, the chances are then you are also white and male. And, you know, maybe you were around when Pharoah Sanders was playing in clubs and like really like at his peak powers, you know, maybe you were around when, you know, you saw what you perceive to be this style in its original incarnation.
Yeah.
And I think you're right to suggest that seeing the band live is the X factor. You know, mm-hmm. I first saw Kamasi and The Next Step after the album came out when they played their first round of New York gigs in August. And that first time I saw them, the light bulb went off, you know, just as I had hoped it would. It was like, ah, okay. They played for about 2.5 hours. It really had that swirling kind of mm-hmm. Deep murk mm-hmm. Mysticism that, you know, you mentioned. And I got it, you know. And if you've never had that experience with this music, I could see to some extent why you would be sort of resisting it. At the same time, you know, like, so this album was not on my best albums list because I feel like as an album, it didn't do that for me.
Right.
But I recognize that this is like a real force, you know, and I think that the level of acclaim that Kamasi Washington and his crew are receiving now, and it's, you know, when I say that, I'm not just talking about like blog posts and like positive notice from GQ. I mean, like he's booked at pretty much every big festival that he could play. You know, he's playing at Coachella.
Yeah.
He's going to be at Big Ears. I mean, you know, a bunch of places in Europe. I mean, he's getting a lot of these gigs. On the one hand, you could say that he's taking gigs away from other jazz musicians, but that's not true because no jazz musicians get these gigs. You know, he really has broken through. And in a way, I kind of think that the only real comparison that you can make in the current Kamasi trajectory is to Charles Lloyd in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the template. That's the only time we've seen this happen like this before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at jazz critics' response to Charles Lloyd in 1968, there are parallels to be drawn between the way that Kamasi is being received in the jazz press today.
I think that's true. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of repertory, which comes up every year. Jazz is always checking itself out, looking at its old family photos and trying to figure out how to use them. And this year, there were a couple of interesting examples of that. One was a record, a very interesting record by a cooperative trio of the cellist Tamika Reed, the flutist Nicole Mitchell, and the drummer Mike Reed. And the idea was a record all of compositions written by members of the AACM, the Chicago organization that's been around for 50 years and has, you know, nurtured several generations of avant-gardism and has its own particular kind of politics and also like sound. I mean, like mm-hmm. regional flavor, attitude expressed through music.
It's so interesting that this is, you know, that you bring this up in our sort of repertory conversation because the AACM, which is this sort of, I think of it as this like galactic enterprise. There's so many different sort of regions of sound, but they all sort of belong to the same larger body somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a 50th anniversary year for the AACM. We saw a lot of really good stuff come out of that. I put this album, Artifacts, on my best album list because I love the playing on it. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of really great insight and these musicians clearly understand each other. But also there's a sort of something about it is almost perverse and wonderful because the AACM, even among the people who love these artists, I feel like there's not enough recognition of these composers as crafters of song, you
mm-hmm,
know?
Mm-hmm.
And so to take an album and say, like, we're going to do a repertory album of AACM composers, it's a weirdly counterintuitive move. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be much more conventional for Tomika Reed and Nicole Mitchell and Mike Reed to
do new stuff.
To do completely new stuff in the spirit of. Right. You know, and say like, oh, this is our piece for Anthony Braxton. And,
right.
You know, but to take the tunes and play them, it's like, wow.
Well, the ACM wasn't formed as a repertory organization. Very much the opposite in a way. It was founded to be self-perpetuating and all that, but not necessarily to be holding up the works of its members as, you know, things to travel through time forever. And
that's the thing. Even the living composers
played regularly.
Even the living composers represented on this album don't play this music anymore.
Right. True. So here's three historians, the flutist Nicole Mitchell, the cellist Tomika Reed, the drummer Mike Reed, playing a version of Composition 23B by Anthony Braxton. That was Composition 23B, written by Anthony Braxton from the record Artifacts, by Tomika Reed, Nicole Mitchell, Mike Reed. What are we missing when talking about repertory this year?
I was really fascinated by the idea not only of kind of historical reimagining. You know, this was a year when we celebrated centennials for Frank Sinatra and Billie Holiday, and there were albums and concerts in honor of that. You know, the AACM produced anniversary stuff. But John Scofield... The guitarist John Scofield made an album called Past Present, and the title was very meaningful. And in it, he reunited an old band of his from the early 90s. Mm-hmm. This group basically ended its run in, I think, 1992 or 93 with Joe Lovano on tenor saxophone, Bill Stewart on drums, and the bassist Dennis Irwin is no longer with us, so they had Larry Grenadier play on the record. It was such a simple idea, and the cool thing is he wrote all new music for this band. And so it's an album of new tunes for an old band. I think the record's really good. I didn't put it on my list because it was almost too perfect a time travel capsule, yeah. Even though the music's new. But I saw this band at the Blue Note and just thought they were glorious, you know. And in a way, you know, I didn't see them live in the very early 90s. But in a way, I feel like there's no way that they could have been better than they are now, because Bill Stewart is such a great drummer.
Yeah.
He was a very young man when they were first making their impact.
Yeah.
And he's now kind of one of our like mid-career masters. And this band just was so smart and so kind of physical and comfortable and insightful and slangy. You know, there was just everything you want out of a four-piece kind of post-bop group.
So it's a different idea of repertory, where it's not repertory of material, it's repertory of
personalities,
of a band,
yeah.
of a band chemistry, which makes sense. I mean, because the bands are the thing. If we're talking on a certain level,
right.
About, you know, sort of serious,
well, you know,
jazz
reunions are often, you know, a big story in pop, right?
Mm-hmm.
Coachella just announced that Guns N' Roses will be playing.
Yeah.
LCD Sound System will be playing. I mean, every year there's a handful of like big trumpeted reunions. And, you know, when it happens in jazz, it's not usually as big a deal because jazz musicians just keep playing with each other in different combinations.
That's right.
But I think there's an argument to be made for every once in a while there's a band that broke up a long time ago that really should give it another shot.
Right.
You know? And this Scofield group, even though one member's missing, the idea of Scofield, Lovano, Stewart, and a really good bass player who has relationships with all those guys, it just really worked.
So Coachella next year, Steve Coleman, Dave Holland.
Love it.
Marvin Smitty Smith.
Yep. That?
So let's talk about grand visions. There were some jazz composers out there, composers, musicians, really built up their work into something big in one way or another. Obviously, Kamasi Washington is one of those examples.
It's funny, you know, Kamasi had your number one album. Steve Coleman had my number one album.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, easily say that these are two people with grand visions and these are two albums with grand visions.
That's right. What about Maria Schneider?
Maria Schneider had my second highest album. And this is another consensus album among our peers, the Thompson Fields. It's a beautiful, gorgeous, and extremely accomplished album. I think it may be her best album.
So what's so grand about it?
You know, she has been, for a long time now, a composer and arranger of, you know, incredible nuance. And, you know, she's so precise. And she has a mastery of both sort of micro and macro. I think that she handles the mechanics of large ensemble orchestrating so deftly. But you never really get lost in the granular details. You always feel sort of carried along as if by a current or a breeze.
That's right. That's an organic motion.
And this is, you know, she has cultivated an orchestra that is deeply, deeply in tune with her vision and with her way of working. You know, she conducts the orchestra. She doesn't play an instrument in the band. And there are moments on this album when, you know, the entire organism seems to shift together. And it's, you know, it's almost imperceptible. Rhythmically, harmonically, there are things that happen here that, you know, it doesn't feel like a machine. It feels like a jellyfish, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. How is this happening?
Sure.
You know, there's like, you know, there's more than a dozen people all playing really intricate stuff, you know, and what you think of when you hear it is like her intention would be for you to think of like a field of wheat kind of like blowing in the breeze. And you do, you see these mental pictures, you know, she's very interested in a kind of naturalist impulse. And I think she communicates it really incredibly well.
And you see the pictures in the album package. We're talking about the record, The Thompson Fields by Maria Schneider Orchestra. Let's hear one track from that called Arbiters of Evolution. That was Arbiters of Evolution, Maria Schneider Orchestra. Can you talk for just a minute about this record as artifact?
Maria Schneider is maybe the most prominent voice from the jazz world who has spoken out against Spotify and other streaming services. She's been on, you know, news programs talking about the devaluation of music, the need for artists to push back against what seems to be a pretty overwhelming and inevitable tide. So her response has been to completely take control of the whole process. You know, she is probably the most well-known person working with Artist Share, which is, you know, it preceded, I think, Kickstarter, you know, but it's mm-hmm. this idea of kind of buying into the experience. She has patrons, you know, who give both small and larger amounts. And with this album especially, she labored to put together a real kind of art object. You know, this is, if you own this CD, and I urge you to get it, it's beautiful. You know, it's a really nice package. It's in a sort of hardbound book. It has all these lovely photographs. You know, she really wanted to put together this thing that feels special as you hold it, feels special as you listen to it. It sounds incredible. It's a very expensive sounding album. And so at a moment when things seem to be fracturing and the whole experience seems to be moving towards a scrappier experience, she says, no, I'm going to give you the most lush, luxurious experience that you can get.
Sure. So also on that track, Arbiters of Evolution, from the Maria Schneider record, The Thompson Fields, there was a solo, right?
Yes.
Nominated for a Grammy.
Donny McCaslin plays the tenor solo. It's really kind of like a like an aria for him, I feel like. He's also been in the news lately. I wrote a piece about his role on the new David Bowie album, Black Star. It's not minor. The band on Black Star is the Donny McCaslin Quartet.
And I think that's actually kind of interesting because if you listen to that record, you actually are hearing what goes on at the 55 bar.
Oh, yeah.
When you hear Donny McCaslin's group.
Yeah.
It's not like David Bowie took a tiny pinch of that and applied it to, you know, his own thing.
Right.
He basically took it whole.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, the first time I heard that album, and even really the first time I heard the lead track, the title track, late last year, it was very clear to me, you know, who these guys were and what they were up to. You know, there are so many examples of jazz musicians being used in one way or another on, you know, pop albums. It's mm-hmm. That's not a story. But it's really rare to have somebody completely plug into that matrix and say like, oh, I really like the sound of your band. Let me just get in there.
Sure.
You know, I was thinking about this. The only real example I can think of that's super prominent might be Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Yeah, with, you know, the Shadows and Light tour.
I was just going to say.
You know, and that's even different because, you know, Michael Brecker, Pat Metheny, Jaco Pastorius, that wasn't a working band. I mean, Metheny and Pastorius had a thing, but this is really unusual. It's a real testament to, you know, Bowie's kind of his willingness to just go there.
Yeah.
And these musicians rose, you know, they sort of rose to the occasion because they're not losing the thread.
Yeah.
You know, like the album is not like a bunch of noodly jams. Like, you know, they're also sort of executing their orders.
Let's talk about a couple of individual people who may not have been profiled on 60 Minutes and may not have shown up in lots of critics' polls necessarily, but who kind of caught our ear this year. For mm-hmm. me, one of the people that I put on my top 10 list was this Spanish pianist, Marta Sanchez, who did a record with her group that's based in New York called Partenica, P-A-R-T-E-N-I-K-A, that I really admired. It's just a good, a good modern sounding group playing flowing, slightly folk-like tunes.
Yeah.
Not simple, but easy to listen to. Was there one for you?
Yeah, it's funny. I think last year on this very episode of Popcast,
yes.
We did something similar, and I think I mentioned the pianist Matt Mitchell.
Yes.
I'm going to just mention him again.
Okay.
Because, if anything, he had an even better year in 2015. First of all, he's a sideman who travels widely and does great work everywhere he goes. He's on that Rudresh Mahanthapa record that we mentioned at the top.
Mm-hmm.
He's also on a Tim Byrne album,
yeah,
on ECM. He's in that Snake Oil band. He was on a Darius Jones record, the alto saxophonist Darius Jones. He was on the Dave Douglas Quintet album.
Yep.
And that band also, you know, released the entirety of their week at the Jazz Standard for download. He's everywhere, you know. I also saw him just completely take over in some ways this set by the John Arabagon Quartet,
yeah,
at the Jazz Standard. On top of all of that, Matt Mitchell released an album this year, or last year, called Vista Accumulation.
Mm-hmm.
Two CDs. When I reviewed it, I suggested that it might best be taken with an intermission,
mm-hmm,
because it's an incredibly dense and complex and sort of intellectual body of work.
Yeah.
But it's also very sort of inviting in certain ways. He's working with Chris Speed on clarinet and tenor saxophone, and the compositions are very kind of, they're like little labyrinths, but they do draw you in.
Well, let's hear an example of that from Matt Mitchell's record Vista Accumulation. Let's hear a little bit of All the Elasticity. Nate Shenan, a number of people who were very important to jazz died in 2015.
True.
Clark Terry died, Gunther Schuller. Then two people whose histories were linked in interesting ways, Ornette Coleman and Paul Blay. Paul Blay just actually did not die in 2015, but he died on January 3rd, 2016, within the past year. How did you feel about, I'm talking about Coleman and Blay in, and in particular. You were talking to me earlier about how like they left and it feels like something was has been sort of like sucked out of the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Ornette's creative energies were so important to not just to jazz culture, but to culture. You know, there was a real sense that Ornette Coleman and what he made and what he stood for, you know, when that left, I think that there was a real feeling of a void, you know. And Paul Blay is connected to that and has his own sort of center of gravity. His loss will be felt much more acutely in the jazz world than beyond it. But, you know, they work together. They spoke to each other sort of musically. And I think that to have lost both of them, you know, within the space of a year, you know, that's a real punch in the gut.
I was thinking a lot about the differences between them because, you know, they play together on that recording from 1958. That's like it's like one of the most widely heard jazz bootlegs in the world.
Right.
Of it's actually Paul Blay is the leader, but Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry. It's like the Ornette Coleman group playing with Paul Blay at the Hillcrest Club in L.A. And it's documented how Paul Blay sort of, though he was going toward this direction of like, I want more freedom, I want more freedom, that when he heard what Ornette was up to, it turned on a light bulb and he realized that he didn't have to use 32-bar song forms as much anymore. He could sort of do what he wanted. He could present music sequentially, serially, rather than repeating anything.
And with a kind of folk-like essence in some ways, like not as a cerebral.
Right, that the vernacular sounds can have a place in that. But I was thinking, you know, with Ornette Coleman, there was a real sweetness about him and also about his music. And there are ways in which his music was traditionally pleasing, is really pretty and touching, you know. But Paul Blay was like rougher.
Ben, you wrote the obituaries for both of these men. Fantastically, if I might add. Those, you know, both of your obituaries are required reading.
Thanks.
But I noticed when I read it that your Paul Blay obituary, I think one of the very first words in it is obdurate.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a perfect word.
He said many times, basically, screw the audience.
Right.
They don't know what they want. They're just here, you know, for whatever reason. Don't pay any attention to the audience. And he also said things like, well, I mean, he's on film saying this. He said, one doesn't practice. One doesn't rehearse. You know, like,
what that makes me think of is that, you know, by contrast, Ornette would actually, in theory, if not always in practice, he would sort of say, well, the audience, what they have to say is as valid as what I have to say.
Right.
So why don't they come up and play the instruments, you know?
Right.
It's like a radically, diametrically opposed ideal
of
the artist and the receiver.
In any case, for both of them, there's something about their confidence, however it comes through in the music, that's totally intoxicating and inspiring. That's the sort of thing we look for. Nate Shenan, thanks for coming in and talking about the last year in jazz.
Onward.
That's our show, and thanks for listening. You can hear a lot of this music on our Spotify playlist. Read what we've written about jazz in 2015 and the beginning of 2016 at nytimes.com/music. Tamara Best on the ones and twos, Jocelyn Gonzalez on post-editing, and we'll see you next week.